Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther along with Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky. And today we're going to discuss an article by one of our senior fellows. So Peter Husey wrote an article in Warrior Maven. If you've never been to Warrior Maven, Google it, look it up. It's got some great pieces. It was an article he was responding. Peter was responding to an article written in The Hill by Tara Drozdenko from the Union of Concerned Scientists. And his article is entitled Nuclear Weapons Essay, Rust to Obsolescence or Modernize to Credibility. And it was a response to this Hill article from Tara Drozdenko, who was arguing that we need, and this is like the 50th, 60th time we've heard this sort of argument, that we got to get rid of the ICBMs. And so, of course, Peter being Peter has heard this many times and, you know, was finally fed up and wrote a reply. And it's a good reply. And, you know, gents, I don't know about you, but this argument, one of the things that I've wondered about for the arms control and disarmament community that repeatedly argues get rid of the ICBMs. What the Russians could be launching nuclear weapons, you know, in NATO, and the Chinese could be launching them at Taiwan, and the arms control and disarmament community would be arguing we need to get rid of the ICBMs. There's no set of facts anywhere that would change their minds. And one of the questions I've long had is, what is the fascination amongst the arms control community with eliminating ICBMs? Why do they specifically hate them so much? Do either one of you guys have an answer to this question? Because I've never really got one, other than they're destabilizing and they're bad. And, you know, go ahead, Jim.
I have a quick answer for you, Adam. I tend to agree. I think we need to get rid of ICBMs. I think we need to convince China to do it first, Russia to do it second, Iran to do it third. And, you know, as they get rid of them, we'll see how less, more stable or less stable will be. But so there is I would agree with that kind of disarmament. And that's just my start. So that argument works well for me. What about you?
Curtis, I'm going to ask you to step up your game. This was not I would have had more confidence in Jim's answer had it been a math problem, but absent a math problem, I'm not confident.
I actually like Jim's answer. It is right. Listen, yeah, it's intellectually lazy to continue to make the same arguments that ICBMs are somehow destabilizing or we're going to save some vast amount of money by cutting them or not modernizing them. They are, in fact, the cheapest of the three legs and are certainly the most responsive because they are, you know, sitting in those holes, in the upper Midwest of the United States. And there's a lot of issues, and I'm sure we probably will delve into a little bit of those today as to why we need all three or what happens if you get rid of one. But I would argue here today that this is a tired argument, I'm eager to dig into to the good doctor. I'm going to call her Dr. Tara. No disrespect intended. I just don't want to butcher her last name. I respect that. And so, Dr. Tara's opinion. I'm interested in tearing into it, but it is there's just no value to cutting the ICBM. If you really want to save money, it's probably one of the other legs you might want to get after.
Well, how about make the argument that she made, Curtis. Give us your best Tara Drozdenko argument here.
Drozdenko, all right. Well, I can't give you the argument. I can give you the counter argument. But something that is interesting here is that she says that she's really getting after the Sentinel, the recent, you know, again, we've had a previous podcast. We've talked about the Nunn McCurdy breach on Sentinel, the fact that it's kind of blown through its congressional ceilings for increased costs. And she notes, you know, the whopping 37% of its original budget of $96 billion. And again, we've pointed out, Adam, I think you and I have published an article recently where we addressed that half of that 37% is just in the 4 years of inflation, which is about 20%. And that kind of inflation is very difficult to predict in advance. You know, that is something that to be fair to the system, right, that we have to acknowledge. And she cites, besides the quote unquote out of control costs, which are still very small numbers in the grand scheme of our defense, that she notes that our analysts, I'm presuming she's the talking about our as in the Union of Concerned Scientists analysts, which was published in 2020, explains why silo-based ICBMs are not essential to national security. So again, you know, this is the kind of argument that I would not accept from my graduate students. Citing something that is as topical as nuclear deterrence with four-year-old data, when the world has changed so much since 2020, is really almost intellectually dishonest. You really have to understand a lot has happened since that, since 2020, right? Regardless, never mind the recovery from COVID, but we've got, you know, the invasion of Ukraine in 2022 and all of the nuclear coercion and threats that came from Putin since then and that we are still enduring today, and the discovery of the rapid expansion of the Chinese nuclear deterrent, the building and the construction of 300 some odd ICBM silos out in the Gobi Desert, as well as the remaining portions of their expansion in their nuclear enterprise, and of course North Korea's rapid expansion as well. Some estimates are that they're on their way to having between 300 and 500 warheads by the end of the decade. These are issues that we weren't really thinking about as being possible in 2020, and she's citing 4-year-old information as her relevant data for her argument as to why we don't need these weapon systems anymore. Frankly, thankfully, Congress is not buying this, and neither will the American people.
Yeah, it's and she cites, you know, these false arguments that we have a launch on warning policy. That's not true.
We have never had a launch on warning policy. You can go back as far as 1979 and read President Carter's PD-59. It is declassified. You can find it on the internet, and it explicitly states that the United States does not have a policy of launch on warning. Again, it is intellectually dishonest not to do that kind of basic research before you make arguments that just simply don't exist. These are not arguments that former practitioners would make.
Yeah, Adam, I want to take you up on your challenge to try to make this argument. I always like looking at things from the other side, but I also want to point out that Peter Husey is one of our senior fellows, and he does write as well as run seminars for NIDS. And if you haven't been to any of the seminars that he operates, and I would suggest you contact NIDS to do that, you would find that a lot of these topics are covered. So with that, I want to take this argument. So what I see is the argument is we need to get rid of our missile defense because, one, we'll save money. And number two, they're a big target for someone else. And number three, that would be bad because if they're targeted, many, many people will die. So let's take this apart one at a time. So getting rid of any part of our deterrent will save money, I guess, if you don't count the flip side of that. If it is deterring war, which is the argument we make. So I'm going to make her argument. It's not deterring war. Well, I don't know what proof there is of that, because we certainly see, as the picture behind me shows, our adversaries are building their ICBM fleets quite well. If you want to argue that's a deterrent, it certainly is. I mean, the United States has not offered to attack, at least as far as I know, in a policy of any of those countries that have nuclear weapons and nuclear ICBMs. So I'd say that deterrent is there. Now, I'm sure we have other policy that may work against that. I sort of say this tongue in cheek. But my point is that they are there 24/7, 365 days a year, maintaining that peace. So when you compare costs, you have to argue the flip side of that cost, that getting rid of them will cause peace. Well, we already have the peace, at least between nuclear countries. So one would argue that that argument needs a little bit more shoring up, or as Curtis says, might be a lazy argument. The second argument made is that they become targets. And my answer is, if you're going to target something that's protected and underground and very robust and has the ability, if you miss it, to come back and bite you as they do, then it certainly is an interesting target, but a whole lot different target than, say, a city with a couple hundred million who don't have the ability to come back and bite you, that are soft targets on top of the ground and are dependent upon each other for their life and daily welfare. So having missile fields that become a target, in my opinion, is much better than having cities that are unprotected as unprotected soft targets. So we have to make the two-side argument here. But that's her argument, is that we will destroy, you know, these targets are there and people will die. Now, the third argument, and I've raised this before in this Princeton study, and I have due respect for the people that do these studies. However, every time a study is done in this regard to how many people are going to die from the fallout that's going to occur if a nuclear weapon is dropped on every Sentinel site or every Minuteman III site, if a bomb is going to hit there and it's going to cause fallout around the United States, all these people are going to die. They leave one thing out, and that's this exposure of people not responding to the fact that nuclear bombs have gone off. And that is also a little bit on the lazy side. If a bomb went off near me, and if we did do what we used to do, duck and cover, civil defense drills, radiation monitoring. I'm in Studio B. If I was in Studio A, I have radiation detectors behind me. I don't have them available right now, but we used to pass out civil defense detectors. We had fallout shelters that people were aware where they are. People are going to go to places where they aren't going to be exposed to the radiation. And that radiation in the fallout falls off rapidly following the detonation. So as it's transported from these faraway places where these missiles are being are stored and where the detonation occurs, as that fallout moves along, it is radioactively decaying. So when it lands on the ground and gets very near to people, it is less dangerous. And a lot of these studies do not take that all into account. Or people, as I say, going underground for 24 hours. 24 hours, the 7-10 rule. I'm going to let people look it up in my podcast. If you look at the 7-10 rule, and please do, so I'm not going to give it to you. I'm going to give you an assignment, audience. Go out and look in that in terms of radiation response, and you'll find out how quickly the radiation is reduced in that fallout. So these are three things I pulled out of this article that I said, you know, this is just lazy reporting. So what is the real answer, Adam, to what we're talking about? Well, we're trying to find an argument to get rid of something that we have, instead of finding an argument that says, what does it do and what are the alternatives? Because when you do that, what is the alternative to getting rid of our ICBM missile fleet and our nuclear ICBM missile fleet? What's the alternative? Be a soft target? I don't want to be a soft target. Do you?
Yeah. No, that's a better argument. And it sort of spurs me to offer some advice to our listeners. So, hello, friends. This is your friend Uncle Adam here. And I just want to remind you that whenever you hear someone with a PhD in physics talk about nuclear strategy, you know, don't listen because they don't know anything about what they're talking about.
PhD, are you talking about?
So,
who are you talking about? Because I think someone here with a PhD in engineering physics is sort of pushing back against
you. I'm talking about our plasma physicist, Dr. Drozdenko, and the other many, many authors at the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist who talk about subjects they know nothing about, mm-hmm. i.e. nuclear right. strategy, employment doctrine, presidential decision-making, all of the things that people who do this for a living are experienced with versus people who work at, you know, ideologically based think tanks that have the there's always, you know, think about it. There are programs at universities in America that fundamentally violate the premise of the university. And that is that they have a preset solution to every problem. That is the arms control and disarmament program at, and you pick a place, the Monterey Institute, Harvard. They've already decided what the answer is. And the idea of pre-deciding what the answer is to every given problem is antithetical to the scientific method. I mean, could you imagine if you did that, it would, where you already knew the answer and then you just asked questions to get to the answer you already had.
Now you're talking my piece here, Adam. Exactly. Scientific method is to go into the process and look at the options. This is why I always say I like looking at things from both sides. I'm willing to try to make your argument for you from the other side, as long as you're willing to make the argument from my side, and we'll look at what the outcomes are. And that's the piece of this article that really bothers me. What are the alternatives? We haven't, there's not a piece in here about the alternative. What's the alternative? Roll over and die? That's not really an alternative that I have.
There
in
is
my
no
book.
Alternative, right? So the goal here is to disarm, and it's to advocate for disarmament, and they'll do it one leg at a time. And the target right now is the ICBM, and because it presents the most numerous of targets, and because it looks so large, I think there's a guess or an estimation that is the most expensive, when it is not. It is not the most expensive. You know, what's interesting here is that if you want to really make the intellectual argument that sitting fixed targets in the middle of the continental United States, which if attacked, you absolutely know you're under attack. You know, submarines can be lost, airplanes can crash, but an attack on an ICBM silo is very difficult to think of being anything other than an attack on the ICBM silo, right? So you know exactly where you're, you know, what you're coming from here. And so the idea that that we just need to get rid of them so that we are somehow safer seems odd. But again, if you want to argue that the fixed essence of 400 plus ICBMs is somehow a waste of money. It is odd to me that the good doctor, Dr. Tara, doesn't say, well, let's put all of those missiles on mobile launchers and we'll hide them in the mountains and we'll move them around in the deserts and keep them and move them where there might be even less human, surroundings.
But that's not the point.
Well, I understand
it's
that.
Never
it's,
the
that's
point.
Why it's intellectually lazy, because they don't make the argument really that I should say that it is a red herring to say that we're safer by not having fixed missiles. When the answer really is if you think that fixed missiles are a problem, then give us an alternative as to how you're going to place the balance of the nuclear deterrent. Are you going to advocate for more submarines and more missiles there? Are you going to advocate for more bombers and more weapons there? Or again, ICBMs in a mobile platform to where they can go about. And you're right, Adam. The answer is no, because the ultimate goal here is not the intellectual argument of the validity of that leg. It is the goal to erase or eliminate that leg. And that one's first, and we'll work to the next. And they never, Dr. Tara never, I would venture to guess, I could be wrong, and I welcome the emails, NIDS at thinkdeterrence.com, that there is an article from any of these authors advocating for Russian and Chinese and North Korean ICBMs to be eliminated as Jim mentioned first. Where are those arguments first? Because I'm telling you, the easiest country in the world to deter is the United States. And so if you really want to disarm the world, which I will argue is bad, because all you do in a nuclear-free world is make conventional warfare great again, disarm the American, the democracies first. It's just the same old, same old. It's an easier pool to wade in. And the reality is if they can get the other guys to do it first, my guess is the West will follow suit.
Yeah, Curtis, I would say, you know, you point out one thing here that I can't wrap my head around. So I'm going to pass a question to you and Adam. And that is, what is the end goal? So you start saying the end goal is disarmament. I don't think the end goal is disarmament, because once you disarm, now what? What happens once the United States disarms from nuclear weapons? Is your end goal to bring the whole system down? Or is the end goal, you believe this is going to lead to peace somehow? Is the end goal that we're going to take that money and turn it into turnips to send around the world to feed everyone? What is the real end goal here? And I can't see any of that in this intellectual process of arguing that we get rid of these weapons.
Well, the end goal is to disarm the United States, because what you got to understand, so Herbert, you need to go back and read Herbert Marcuse. Herbert Marcuse is the father of the neo-Marxist movement. And much of the disarmament community is of the school of the neo-Marxist school. And that is that America is the problem in the world. It's racist. It's colonialist. It's sexist. It's all of these ists and isms. And then if we can defang and we can limit the ability of the United States to harm the world, then, you know, the Russians will not need nukes themselves because we're no threat to them. The Chinese won't need nukes because we're no threat to them. And with an America that is defanged, then all of these things will sort of fall into place. And then without America advocating for capitalism and free markets and personal liberty, then we can ultimately come to the socialist utopia that was originally discussed by Marx and Engels, and it failed because it was revolution based on class, when in reality Marcuse, whose focus is revolution in America, figured out that you got to go by these other isms. And so they want all of these other things so that we can ultimately have Marxism in America. Nuclear weapons are just one tool that allow the United States to continue to perpetuate. And I'm not saying any of this in jest or sarcasm or any of that. I'm 100% certain. And that is the fundamental problem, is that we have to defang America so that it cannot be a global superpower that advances ideals that are directly contrary to the neo-Marxist ideology.
Adam, I may not disagree with you on this larger fundamental piece, and I'll get to turn it over to Curtis. But do you think Dr. Tara Drozdenko was thinking that when she wrote her article? That's really... What drove this scientific study to push this?
Well, okay. So let me offer less nuanced, a little broader argument. And this is where I think Dr. Tara, because if you're affiliated with these sorts of disarmament organizations, it's really about the ideological transformation of the world, right? To move it from a less anarchic, realist, you know, self-help, balance of power kind of world into transforming it into something that's much more cooperative and mutually aligned, right? And so those who advocate, the idealists who advocate for this transformation, believe that for that transformation to happen, disarmament, specifically nuclear disarmament, the act of doing that will create the transformation process. That the act of sort of submitting your security and sovereignty to the collective will somehow transform the world into this sort of mutual reliance, for lack of a better term. Now, the realists who see the world as it is will say that, well, really, in order for that transformation to happen, you have to first provide some sort of overarching power that will provide or guarantee the security and sovereignty issues that that those countries who are already armed would require in order to disarm. And so, and until that kind of world happens, nations will not disarm. So it becomes sort of this catch-22 chicken or the egg argument that transformation, that disarmament cannot happen until transformation is completed. Whereas the idealists say we cannot have transformation until we start the disarmament process. And so, so this is sort of that continuing, this sort of pendulum swinging left and right, if you will. I don't mean that in a political sense, just in a pendulum sense, that as you look at the world, if your goal is to create that transformational world, which I believe it's possible that that's where Dr. Tara is coming from, and those that she is supporting, that the disarmament community seeks that method. And so it's easier to start in the West, right? Water flows through the path of least resistance, than it is to stand in China, Russia, or Pyongyang and advocate for this, right? No one's listening over there. And so if you want to continue to collect your donations and get to the right cocktail parties, advocating for this kind of behavior in the West and specifically in the United States is how you do it. That is what I think the goal is there.
But I would argue it's not idealism. That's a nice way of saying it. Because if you'll remember, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist has published articles, you know, the queering of deterrence. They've published articles about white supremacy and deterrence. They're publishing these articles that are, it's called critical theory. And critical theory is, you know, where we get, you know, critical race theory. We have all these other theories that are critical theories. And there you can see that they're bringing all of that into the entire argument over the elimination of nuclear weapons. So Marxism is in the mix of this. It's under the guise of critical theory, which then talks about, well, we can't listen to you, Curtis, or you, Jim, because you're just white supremacists. So therefore, we're going to dismiss anything you have to say, and you're obviously wrong because, you know, by nature, you're a white supremacist and deterrence is white supremacy. And then we'll pick on gender and we'll pick on race and we'll pick on all these things.
I think either way we look at it, Adam, it is about politics, right? And it's and geopolitics as well as national politics and so forth. And so and that's why, you know, when you think about nuclear weapons and nuclear deterrence, you really are talking about political weapons much more so than you're talking about military weapons. And it is only by how they are wielded in that sense. And so I think that that is interesting. But I think if you want to make your arguments, you've got to know more about what you're arguing here. And, you know, when you have statements in their piece like Dr. Tara does here where she says, quote, our submarines and bombers can carry so many nukes that they can devastate our adversaries, and they each possess strengths that ICBMs lack. So what exactly do ICBMs bring to the table? You know, and so they, I mean, that's something I would...
I don't know.
You know, how is that postured? How do you know the adversary is afraid of whatever those weapon systems can carry?
Yeah.
How do you know they're deterred by that?
I have a hard time believing they're that ignorant. I don't believe these people are that ignorant.
Well, that was my point. That was my point in saying what's the end goal? Because I really don't. I think honestly, I find it difficult to see someone scientifically looking at this problem from a multitude of angles and saying, what are the inputs? How do I apply those inputs? What are the outputs? And what can I conclude from those? As you said, Adam, it seems like an article that writes itself backwards. We want to disarm. So what can we argue that can take that away? And I could do that for anything. You know, I want to get rid of seatbelts. Okay. So I'll find the number of fires that occurred in cars and said, look, a person died from a fire in a car. We need to get rid of seatbelts. And here's a person whose car went in a pond and they couldn't get out of their seatbelt in time. So they drowned. We need to get rid of seatbelts. Okay. What's the alternative to seatbelts? I mean, we could do that for anything. If you draw your conclusion, you want to get rid of it ahead of time, then you can find all the counterexamples. But that's not the scientific process. The scientific process, and certainly I would even argue that it's not just the scientific process. It should be in all of our writings. What we're doing in GSR is we're looking at things critically. Not everything is great with nuclear weapons. I'm going to say that up front. Not everything is great. There are costs involved. There are hazards involved. There are, as Curtis said, we don't know what's really going to deter our adversaries. We just know historically what has worked. Things are going to be dynamic. They're going to change. We have to look at how those things change. We have to be on top of that. Not everything is perfect. I would never sit there and say that. However, it's the best game in town right now. Mm-hmm. Until you teach me how to build photon torpedoes. And then maybe we'll have something new.
So Adam and Jim, let me ask you guys a question. So she says, she kind of closes her article here with ICBMs are a relic of a bygone era. Adam, what are your thoughts?
Well, what I would argue is that this is largely an example of Joseph Goebbels' famous quote, if you tell a lie loud enough and long enough, people will believe it. And so what do? They repeat things that have been disproven over and over, and they just keep repeating them. They never change. There's no amount of evidence. Mm-hmm. Like whenever I've written, you know, to counter these arguments about, you know, we don't have a launch on warning policy, and it's very clear there is nor never has there been one. That doesn't change their argument. So facts are irrelevant. This goes to you, Jim. What you don't understand about this is a religious tenet to a false god, and that false god is disarmament, and one of the tenets to this false god is we're going to get rid of ICBMs, and so therefore when you look at religion, you don't need proof or evidence, you have faith, and these people have faith. And that's really all that matters.
Jim, what are your thoughts? Are ICBMs a bygone
relic of a bygone era? I first have to comment about Adam's God argument. And I don't disagree that many people see this as a false God. I say it's a false analogy. We make a false analogy. We believe, you know, that the socialist view is everyone will kumbaya, get together. There, I used a religious reference there. So we'll all get together and we'll all be happy with each other. And that ignores, you know, if everyone had all the same things, if everyone had all the same food, if everyone had all the same armaments, if everyone had or no armaments at all, we would just get along because that's what we are as humans. And that, unfortunately, is incorrect. You could just look around you. No matter what you have, if you're the second richest person in the world, you know what you want to be? The richest man in the world. You never have enough. And if you're the richest person in the world, you know what you want? You want more. You want the rest of the world. I mean, that's just human nature, and it's ignored in these processes. So going back to the argument, Curtis, are these from a bygone era? Well, I will say that our systems need to be modernized, and we've put them off too long to be modernized. So you want to say a bygone era? Yes, I would agree. We have better systems, better capabilities to implement in order to ensure that our adversaries do not get an upper hand. So if you want to make the argument that way, I would agree. And therefore, I share in the argument that we need to modernize our fleet in a way that becomes more effective, more efficient, and a better deterrent, because I don't want war. That's that piece. Now, this, wait, I'm not done yet, Curtis. I see you ready to talk. Okay. And then my second piece of this is there is no other armament that does what the ICBM does. It's protected in the ground. It's available. The manpower, once it's in the ground, once it's made capable, look how long the Minuteman has been around. My gosh, it's protected us. It's got us through the cold wear. It's done all of these things. So I would say that that is an incredible argument for a system that's kept us at peace, not one that is not going to cause peace. Curtis?
Well, I would say that it is certainly not a bygone era. And one of the examples is the number of nations that are proliferating ballistic missile technology. It is their number one weapon of choice. Just look at the back of Jim's head here if you're watching the video on YouTube or wherever. And, you know, and it allows nations, rightly or wrongly on your perspective, to be able to reach out and touch their adversaries and hold at risk their adversaries in ways that they otherwise never would be able to do. And what is the alternative? If one weapon goes away, it is always replaced with another, right? And so I would much rather have adversaries a much more stabilizing ICBM with predictable flight patterns that I can see and even possibly intercept. Compared that to large amounts of hypersonic cruise missiles, hypersonic glide vehicles that are coming in different directions at super speeds, much more destabilizing, much more at risk. So if you do away with the ICBM in favor of something else, what is that something else? And is it worse? And I would argue, Jim, 9 times out of 10, it is. Adam, I know you're going to wrap us up. I want to close with my parting thought here. And that is this one, another red herring argument that is often made by these folks. And that is that ICBMs in the Western United States are a sponge and that they will wreak utter devastation upon the people of Colorado, Wyoming, Nebraska, Montana, North Dakota, and the surrounding areas. Back in 2021, there was a survey done, a pretty comprehensive national survey for the Mitchell Institute regarding nuclear deterrence. And in fact, questions were asked specifically in 2021 about the value of the Sentinel modernization. And in the question of should the United States have or maintain ground-based nuclear capabilities? And the survey overwhelmingly said yes at 81%. That was broken out by political parties. The GOP, those who identified as GOP, said 88% were supportive of that. Those who identified as Democrat was 73%. And they actually asked those who live in Colorado, Montana, North Dakota, Nebraska, and Wyoming, the ones that Dr. Tara is so nicely concerned about, their support for the ground-based nuclear capability was at a whopping 84%. They are not bothered by this. This does not scare them. It is a part of their lives, and they know that it is a requirement of national security. So again, we can put this one
plus
to bed.
You know, what makes this all worthwhile is cities like Denver and Chicago, which are sanctuary cities and now have large populations of illegal immigrants in them, are protected, and those illegal aliens are protected by these weapons. So therefore, I trump any arguments against it. Okay.
Well, I guess that is true. If you are in the country, you are protected by the American deterrent.
Yeah, Denver being number one, most important city for protection. Yeah. So,
Adam, before you close, you mentioned Herbert Marcosa, so I tried to look this person up. The only thing I found, so our audience knows, is I found an espresso machine with that name and an eau de parfum, but we'll get there later on. So I'll let you close us from here.
Yeah,
it's got to be a spelling error.
You spelled Marcosa wrong, so it's fine. It's fine. All right. So, well, you know, we're at the end of the show. It's been a little bit long. It was a little bit animated. Hopefully it was entertaining. Now, of course, you know, a couple weeks back, Jim Stokes, the director of nuclear policy at NATO, was listening to our 75th anniversary. And he said, hey, Adam, he emailed me and said, hey, Adam, I think you got a couple of points wrong. about the, you know, the utility of the allies and all that. And so he said, sure, come on. And so he came on the show and we talked about it and we had a great, great conversation. That show's already aired. And so we, of course, want to make a similar offer to Tara Drozdenko. Tara, if you think we were wrong, if we were harsh, then we would love for you, your colleagues, anybody to come on the show. We'll have a great discussion. I'll keep Jim from being, you know, too aggressive and Curtis, and we can even talk about Marcuse and, you know, critical theory. We can do whatever you want. So come on the show. We'll talk about it. And the listeners will love it because it'd be a great debate. So, of course, so we got to wrap the show up. It's been a little bit long today. Thanks to Jim and Curtis for joining me. And, of course, we want to thank you, the listeners. And, as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.